and welcome to Conversations with the Legal Academy, a podcast from the University of Arkansas School of Law. My name is Dorinda Sharp.
And I'm Colin Hesse. On this episode, Dorinda talks with Laura Hines, professor at the University of Kansas School of Law. Hines was on campus as part of the law school speaker exchange to discuss her research on class action lawsuits.
We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Professor Hines is here for our speaker exchange series, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. Have you been involved with it before and how it all works?
Well, it's a really neat arrangement so that professors at some law schools can have interactions across the country to other law schools. So we have exchange programs with the University of San Diego, and we have one, I think we're starting up with Tennessee, and in part because Dean Stacy Leeds was once on our faculty, we have set up one with Arkansas so that professors at the Arkansas School of Law could come up and give a presentation of their ideas or a work in progress to the KU faculty, and then we occasionally send people down to do the same. So it's a really nice relationship. It keeps the academic world, interconnected and obviously informed about what other people are doing.
And so you're going to be speaking with University of Arkansas faculty this afternoon. What are you going to talk about?
Well, my field of expertise is class actions. I will be talking about informing class members in the class settlement notice about the court's intentions with respect to the remaining funds in a class action settlement.
Okay. So right now, an example of that is Keepsiegel, which was Keepsiegel versus Vilsack, but now has become a contested settlement money residuals.
So Keepsiegel was a lawsuit brought by Indian farmers against the USDA for discrimination, and it resulted in a very large settlement of, I think, $680 million. And the idea was to distribute those funds to the Indian farmers who had been discriminated against, and there was a claims procedure that was set up. Originally, the understanding was, as in most class action settlements, there will be money left over. The claimants, the claim process is imperfect, and people don't always have the documentation or even understand that they had a claim, or maybe they have become deceased. So there is often, if not always, leftover funds after the claims have all been made. And the doctrine that I've been looking at is the doctrine of cypre, which is what do you do with those leftover funds? And one method is cypre, which is it's an old French term for as near as possible. So what you do is you take the funds that haven't been claimed by class members and you think about ways to distribute those funds as near as possible to accommodate or reflect the interests of the class members.
Okay.
In Keepsiegel, over half of the remaining funds are unclaimed. So you have, out of a $680 million settlement, there was only $300 million or so in claims, which leaves you with about $380 million. Which is an enormous remainder.
It's a lot of leftover.
Exactly. It's an enormous remainder. And so the terms of where that money is to go is really important. And the settlement did provide originally for the notion that money would go to something, some entity, some nonprofit entity that helps serve the interests of Indian farmers and particularly, loans around those farms. But it also specifically provided that the money had to be distributed sort of in one chunk and that the recipients of those funds could not be a law firm or an educational institution.
I'm curious as to how you got into that field of study. What led you there? Is that something that you have always been passionate about? Has it come over time? How has it worked?
Right. Well, I have to say that I went through law school. I went to Michigan Law School and did a clerkship afterwards with a judge on the Eighth Circuit, actually, Judge Donald Lay. And I had no experience whatsoever with class actions in law school or during that clerkship, as I recall. And I joined the law firm of Arnold and Porter, which is in Washington, D.C. And my first couple years there, I was working in the communications department. So I was working with FCC cellular license renewals and cable license renewals, and I was not particularly happy in that world because it just wasn't really fitting my interests. And then I just sort of happened upon a partner who I did some pro bono work with, who liked my work and thought of me when a class action got filed against one of the firm's clients. And I started working on that case and ended up really being enveloped in class action law for the next couple years. Our client was Philip Morris. And so this was in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s, when the tobacco companies were being sued for any number of claims involving addiction. And the issues were so sort of cutting edge and provocative. You had a consortium of plaintiff's attorneys on one side trying to really expand and reinterpret the laws of class actions. And so it was really exciting to be a part of it. Ken Starr was the counsel who argued the Fifth Circuit case. And so it was just really, you know, scintillating, exciting stuff. And I love my work. And then when I thought about going into teaching, you know, that was the area that most interested me in terms of developing. I developed my own class at KU about complex litigation and focused on class actions.
Well, it had to be interesting developing your own curriculum.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah, I mean, I did the usual first year course in civil procedure, but this upper level course had not been done yet at KU. And I always get students who are pretty excited about it. And obviously, it has become a pretty big part of the legal landscape. And so a lot of my students do go on to practice what we learn in the upper level course.
So how did you come to teaching, the teaching side of law, as opposed to practice?
You know, that's a really good question. I had thought about it for a while. I had a professor at Michigan who had suggested that it might be something I might be interested in doing. And I really did have to kind of make a decision because I had gone from being sort of unhappy as a young firm associate to being spectacularly happy and very successful as a sort of mid-level associate. And I love living in D.C., and I really sort of love the work I did. But I also had a lot of desire to be – I come from a family of teachers, and so the idea of teaching rather than just representing clients was really appealing to me. And I like the idea of being able to research and think about class actions from a unbiased or at least unpaid for perspective.
Yes.
And so the idea that I could just sort of, you know, research and think and write about what I wanted to say about class actions rather than what necessarily suited my client's interest was really a draw for me.
And what do you find with the students? You said that the ones who take your class are obviously already interested in it, but what do you find from them as far as your career, how they impact what you do?
Well, it is, you know, it's so trite, but it is one of the things that gives my life the most meaning is that I get students, and particularly in this class, who say, you know, this class was my favorite class in law school, and I learned so much. I sometimes get Christmas cards or emails from students after they leave saying, boy, your class really helped me. And, you know, it's a small little piece of success, but it's one I really cherish.
One of the things you mentioned is that while you were in school or right after that you clerked for Justice Lay?
After law school, yeah.
After law school. Would you talk a little bit about that experience and how that has affected what you've done since?
He's somebody who was appointed by Lyndon Johnson. And he was one of the youngest judges, I think, you know, to be appointed to the Eighth Circuit. So by the time I joined him in 1991, he'd been on the bench for a very long time. And he had senior status. He was the chief judge. I shouldn't say senior status. He was the chief judge of the circuit. And we were located in St. Paul, Minnesota. I lived there for a year, worked with him in his chambers in St. Paul with a couple other clerks, but the court often sat in St. Louis as well. So we would go back and forth between St. Louis and St. Paul. And the Eighth Circuit, you know, that Arkansas obviously is a part of, is, in my mind, one of the best circuits to clerk on because it ranges from, you know, Minnesota and the Dakotas all the way down to Arkansas. You have death penalty states. You have, this huge sort of swath of diversity among, you know, sort of a northern plains states with, you know, sometimes you have like, you know, those flight bases up in, you know, in North Dakota. I can't think of what their names. And then all the way down to Arkansas. So it's a really diverse swath of states, and the cases that come, you know, are just sort of all over the map, as opposed to some circuits that sort of seem to have a little bit more of a concentration of certain kinds of cases than others. And so I really loved the Eighth Circuit, and I think the judges on it are really smart and thoughtful. Judge Arnold, Richard Arnold, who was a judge in Arkansas, was somebody I really admired. He was always so smart and so thoughtful, and just was a pleasure to work with on the cases that that my judge sat with him. And then during my clerkship, my judge stepped down from being the chief judge and took senior status, which enabled him to go and what they call ride the circuits. Mm-hmm. So he, for the next, you know, 20 years or something, went around sitting on other circuits. So with him, I sat on the First Circuit with then Judge Breyer, who went on to become Justice Breyer. Mm-hmm. He was on our panel. And then we went down to the Second Circuit and sat with a couple judges on the Second Circuit. And it was really interesting, again, to see the different dockets and the different ways that the that those circuits work, that the judges work. And the Eighth Circuit is a very collegial circuit. And, you know, there's a lot of desire to get sort of consensus and to, you know, there's certainly dissenting opinions, but it's really a cordial circuit. And the First Circuit, at least on the panel that we were on, you know, was very particular about, we would get comments about our opinion that would say things like, I don't like this comma here, or I don't think this word is the right word, or, you know, it was sort of a much much less friendly way of working on the opinions. And we just sort of, you know, it was just a funny, it was a funny side-by-side comparison that you don't really think about. You think sort of all the circuits are basically working the same way. But in fact, the Eighth Circuit, at least it, in my era, the Eighth Circuit was a much, much friendlier place, and I suspect it still is.
So there are cultures within circuits as much as there are cultures within courtrooms based on the judge presiding.
Exactly. And I guess I should say the First Circuit is in Boston, so it's, you know, the New England states, and the Second Circuit is in New York, and it's, you know, New York and Connecticut.
Okay. Are there any particular words of wisdom or life lessons that you remember picking up while there?
You know, I tell my law students that working for a judge in any capacity, whether it's a district court, federal court, appellate court, you know, that is magistrate court, bankruptcy court, you learn so much from being on the other side of the process. The you get to observe a host of litigants and see their strengths and see their weaknesses, see the things that work for them as a matter of advocacy and the things that don't. Mm-hmm. And you get to really be part of the making of the law and not just the arguing for the law. And it's, I mean, it is a heady experience. And to me, it's, you know, at least as valuable as any 1 year in law school. So I really encourage all of my students, if they are up for it, to pursue that as a post-law school exercise.
Before you got your JD from Michigan, you got a bachelor's from Brown in history. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about how your bachelor's informed your time in law school and how it was helpful, what you may have wished you had done differently, you know, what was great and what was maybe could have been better?
So I, for me at least, the history to law was a really sort of obvious or easy path. In part because my focus in history was the 20th century of America. And so a lot of what I did as a history major was to look at, like, the civil rights movement or, you know, the development of the strict scrutiny for gender discrimination or something like that. So I was really interested in the various movements and the legal implications behind those. And so one of the papers that I wrote as a senior in college was about the treatment of the mentally ill and the disabled, and whether or not the laws affecting them should be subject to sort of ordinary scrutiny, you know, like it's anyone else, or should it have a higher degree of scrutiny based on the history of discrimination in this country against people with mental disabilities. And The decision by the Supreme Court that I studied ultimately found that they were not entitled to any heightened scrutiny, and it made me realize that, you know, the law is a vehicle to affect, you know, an enormous amount of change and protection of individual rights, and I got, you know, very very excited about that idea. And so for me, the sort of American history, and particularly the sort of swath of legal history, really excited me about the idea of going to law school and trying to make a difference. Now, I went on to work on class actions and defending Philip Morris, so it wasn't like I actually parlayed my my interest in civil rights into a career in that regard. But I still think, I still believe in the real importance of the rule of law and how it changes society around us, and I consider that to be sort of a, you know, a lifetime worth of interesting work.
Well, so it obviously influenced your path to get to where you are now. We have a lot of pre-law students at the university who have questions about what they should major in, what's best. Do you have any advice for them?
Oh, you know, I would say I think that they should major in whatever interests them. And so if it's engineering, if it's, you know, biology, if it's philosophy, if it's Spanish, you know, I think they should do whatever their passion, wherever their passion takes them. And what I've noticed as a first-year law professor is I always ask my students on the first day of class what their majors were. And it is a wide gamut. I mean, they are all over the map. And I have not identified over my 18 or 19 years of teaching any particular correlation with, you know, are the history ones the successful ones? Are the, you know, philosophy ones the successful ones, or engineering? You know, they all have track records of going on to be really successful lawyers. It's just, you know, if you learn how to think and you learn how to articulate and reason through a particular problem, you know, and you can get that from any discipline, then you can be successful in law school. So I wouldn't make any recommendations to pre-law students except to do what really interests them and excites their enthusiasm for learning.
That's great. Do you have any stories in particular of a student who really stood out because of their passion?
You know, I frequently get, in recent years, it seems like I've gotten a couple of students who've been very excited about working for victims of human trafficking or immigration issues or domestic violence issues. And you really see those. I mean, a lot of times I see those sort of on the very first day of law school, and then I watch them stick with that passion throughout their 3 years, you know, work on getting externships and the like, and then going on to actually make that be their law practice. And that was not my own experience in law school. I was much more unfocused about where I wanted to go, but I really see students who've come in with a particular experience or interest who really are able to hang on to that and go on and have that be their sort of life passion.
Great. Thank you so much for your thoughts today.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
For more information on Conversations with the Legal Academy, show notes, and additional episodes, go to law.uark.edu/podcast. Or you can find us at kuaf.com under the local and podcast link. You can also listen to episodes or subscribe through iTunes or with your favorite podcast app. If you enjoy the show, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, which will help others find us. Music for Conversations with the Legal Academy was written and performed by Josh Woodward. To keep up with us between episodes, follow the University of Arkansas School of Law on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for UARK Law. That's UARKLAW. Thank you for listening.